Okay. Our second reader this evening is Tim Azayas, who happens to be one of the nicest fellows in Pittsburgh. He is truly one of the most generous, spirited poets in this community. He lives in Pittsburgh in Squirrel Hill with his wife, who is a physician. He writes satire, speculative fiction, poetry, and the occasional essay. His work has appeared in over a dozen different countries and 15 languages. He has been a finalist in the British Science Fiction Award, 1998, the Riesling Award, 5 nominations, and has won the Asimov Readers Award for Poetry in 2005. He's a member of the Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange, demeritus of the World Rights, a certified rogue in Layer 1 of the Rascals, Rogues and Rapscallions, and he teaches at Seton Hill University. It's great to have him here reading tonight. Tim Azayas.
Thank you, John. First of all, I want to thank everyone who's involved in keeping this series going, and especially thanks for inviting me back this year. Every season, I think they're going to kick me into the minors again, right? The obligatory marketing moment. I don't have a chapbook. Mine's sold out at second edition. But the Seton Hill Writing Popular Fiction program put together an anthology of how to write prose fiction. My essay about Don't Be a Bobblehead is in here. And so here I am waving it at you, and yes, I have 4 copies in the back. I'd be willing to sell them, but it's $29, and what poet ever has $29? So it's there, but you know. My choices for this evening's poems are based on the following. 1, not reading anything I read last year. And 2, I got tired of my typical weeding operations. Usually when I do a reading, I try very hard to have only one poem with classical reference and only one poem that's definition by negativity. I gave up on that. So it's a lot of classical reference and... Here we go with the defining by negativity. This is my No Solicitors number 1. It's after a sign remembered by my wife and mentioned to me dozens of times in Quincy, Illinois, when she was in college. The sign read, "No Solicitors, No Jehovah's Witnesses." No solicitors, no Jehovah's Witnesses. No masterless samurai, no Vandals, and no Visigoths, no Ostrogoths, no Alans, no Macromanni, no false prophets, no followers of false prophets, no friends of followers of false prophets, no literary critics. No hostage-taking space aliens. No demons. No haughty angels. No desert gin unless in original packaging. No world conquerors. No one who doesn't wear a watch. No one who dislikes Dickens. No one who thinks of Italian cooking as spicy. Listed out a lot of prejudices there, huh? So I am working on the second chapbook. I already know its title. I've been struggling with the title poem for a dozen years now. But here it is in its current rendition, Why Elephants No Longer Communicate in Greek. Perhaps it stems from the Athenians, their execution of Socrates. But centuries later, in Pliny's time, elephants still worked beside us, fought in our battles, fought in our arenas, wrote Latin and Greek, conning their lessons, the slow ones, by the midnight oil. Who knows why conversations end, why we break things off forever? Perhaps something we said, or something they tried to tell us, which we ignored. Clearly, we did not pay attention and did not record the year in which the elephants were no longer writing Greek, or even note it. Nor did scholars heed that we know their preferences in reading. Did the elephants favor Aristotle over Cicero, the Stoics, or with their greater appetites, the Epicureans? Did they care for drama, Master Euclid, penetrate the numbers of Pythagoras? Much has happened to us since the plow first broke furrows back and forth across the ground, but other doors have closed to us. Delphi is still. The gods no longer speak to us, and the elephants have, inexplicably, put their pens aside. I've been commuting by bus mostly to Seton Hill this last term, and it gives me an opportunity to write poems based on things that come to mind as I go or things I see along the road. This is one of those, and it's not yet got a title, not because I'm arrogantly saying this is untitled number 45, but because I haven't come up with a title yet. The importance of a map is the perfect accuracy. His reaction was to insert just one flaw. Trying to find the spot on the chart that no one would ever use, he put it there. The importance of a map is its perfect accuracy. But a map is a metaphor. We say, this is France, but it is only a piece of paper. It folds into quarters, which we have never been able to do with France. I was going to explain where this one came from, but my experience when reading it is that people apply all sorts of other meanings to it, and so it's best left unexplained. This is entitled Numbered. I wish to be numbered among those who came. There will be no time for explanation. The being here is the meaning, is the long story in a single act. Our differences are many, but number me with you. History will make my name smoke, will not know the couch I rose from, the possessions that the enemy will ransack. Here I am. Count me among the rest, this time with you. Similar in a way, I had a friend who had an odd experience. He was doing a documentary film, and he was going over raw footage that's available from the National Archives from World War II, and he was particularly going through the film that was taken when they relieved the concentration camps and the killing camps. When I spoke to him, and it was a couple days later, he was shaking, and he mentioned twice that the thing that most struck him was that there was no soundtrack. He had seen most of this kind of film before, but it's always packaged with music, right? And no, this was just the film, and this bothered him. And I heard that, and I wrote, well, a speculative fiction poem, but here it is, Overview. This is what an atrocity looks like. There is no soundtrack. No violins. Note the bodies. Here. 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 That is a goat that came back to the yard too early. The wounds with the blistering outside the corona are made by 7-phase pulse lasers, which are illegal. Wounds without blistering are not illegal. Do not mistake ceramic shrapnel shards for blistering. Humans could have done this. There is no telling. Change of tone. Oh, how to explain this one. It has a title longer than most poems I've written. It's another one of those negative definition things. And this is my first time actually reading it for the public. So here goes. Title: I really think Celia Ward should have dropped the string of pearls and the coral lipstick and the whole suburban goddess shtick and gone with sheer glamour and femme fatale, infuriating other women and turning men into slavering puddles of meaningless meat. But this poem isn't about her anyway. This is not a poem with an epigraph from Garcia Lorca, because the Lorca epigraphs have been all used up. And this is not a poem with an epigraph from Neruda, as really both those gentlemen deserve to have their every line for themselves. This is not a poem after another poet, though it is after all the poems that came before, not to mention most that will come after. This is not my poem which says chess is death, but which doesn't say that though chess is death, many of its moves can be beautiful. This is not my poem on what the white whale means. And it is not a poem about George Washington's despicable land dealings. And not a poem honoring the American spirit through the metaphor of locomotive smokestack spark arresters. This is not a poem even mentioning Walt Whitman, or pretending that the East River is a river, or a poem that caters to the provincial self-congratulation of those islands off the coast at the mouth of the Hudson, because the truth is that America happens on the mainland, and New York is filled with people who lack the courage to come all the way ashore. This is not my poem with the long title about Celia Ward, nor my poem about the girl who made me choose between her and my teddy bear, nor my poem about the woman who set off all my alarms before she even came around the corner, or the woman whose primary question about Delphi, there's that reference again, was the quality of the shopping there. This might be a poem about things being defined by what they are not, but it isn't a poem using phrases like negative space, and it isn't a poem about the divisibility of paramecia. And it isn't a purple cow poem, or even a list poem, or a skaldic verse, or a poem about not being what might have been. Lurking at the center, though, is the old dragon, or what remains of the dragon, and the awesome question of what comes of setting forth to kill it. Thank you. And my ending poem was a special request, but I noticed that the requester is not here. You know how that goes. So instead, I'm going to end with a poem that won third place for the Riesling Prize some years ago. It was brought to my attention last week when I was at the Nebula Banquet and I was asked to sign a copy of it. And I thought, oh yeah, I kind of like that. So here it goes. It's entitled, "It's All Time Machines," she said. "It's all time machines," she said. And I imagined a cottage industry, every suburban garage with one up on cinder blocks. A revival of brass fittings, of scrimshaw decoration, intaglio accessories, so we arrive in the future with aesthetic values in plain sight. Popping brews, stoking Weber kettles, polishing the chrono rotor, and discussing what decades look good this year. "Kids," she said. "Books, laws, buildings, ideas that will go into the future. We're putting our stamp on it now," she said. "It's all time machines."
Thank you.